Guess the rest of you didn't get the memo that Brad's gone, and I'm here, so you're stuck now. I'm going to do something a little different than I normally do, and we're going to just do a survey of a book of the Bible that I really, really like. A survey is typically a 30,000-foot view of what's there, okay, and it's not a verse-by-verse look at what's there, but rather look at concepts, okay? And we're going to look at Job. If you would, turn to Job, or if you'd like to. It's after Esther and before Psalms, so it's pretty close to the center of your Bible. Job is one of the most fascinating books in the Bible. It serves as an overview of Satan and his wicked activities. And I think that's odd. Job is a book that's usually remembered as the man's response to suffering, or how we respond to things that happen that are bad to us. But that's really not the purpose of Job, believe it or not. Job supports a literal interpretation of the first 11 books of first 11 chapters of Genesis. And it's likely the oldest book in the Bible. If not the oldest, probably the second. Job was not of the line of Abraham. He was a contemporary of Abraham, or at least in that same era, in the patriarchal era. And so it represents a time that was close to the flood and closer to the creation than what we are today. And they had some challenges then, because in the patriarchal era, there was no, God had not put his words down in the book. They didn't have a Bible. In fact, Job being, when I say it was likely the oldest book, the ancient Jews attribute Job to Moses. And Moses wasn't there, obviously, and couldn't have written it. But he most likely, when he was in Midian, out in the desert, getting schooled by God, Midian being close to Uz, which is where Job was from, most likely ran into some of Job's relatives, maybe his grandkids, and got manuscripts from them that described the events of Job's life. And so Moses likely learned a great deal about God there in the desert through the writings of Job. And he took those later, maybe even at that time, and edited those into the current book we have as Job. So it's an interesting book. It's not, as you would think, in the line where God gave his word and his promises to all of us through Abraham, but it was by somebody else, by heathen, by Gentile, who we are. So that to me makes it very fascinating. So let's start, and I'm not going to read the whole book. We only have 20 minutes, but I want to start. The first chapter is really important, and then we're going to do some skipping around. But let's start by reading the first part of Job, chapter 1. Beginning in verse 1, says, "There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was blameless and upright and one who feared God and shunned evil. And he had seven sons and three daughters. Also, his possessions were 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 5,000 yoke of oxen, 5,000 female donkeys, and a very large household, so that this man was the greatest of all the people in the east. And his sons would go and feast in their houses each on his appointed day, and would send and invite their three sisters to eat and drink with them. So it was when the days of fasting or feasting had run their course that Job would send and sanctify them, and he would rise early in the morning and offer burnt offerings according to the number of them. For Job said, 'It may be that my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts.' Thus Job did regularly." In the time of the patriarchs, there was no priestly system. The worship of God was not in a temple, and the patriarch of the family typically took care of the duties of leading worship, leading the worship of God. You know, God said in the very beginning, you leave and cleave. And so your children spring off and take on a wife and or a husband, and they create their own family unit. And that family unit then becomes a patriarchal-led unit that the father's responsibility was to teach and instruct his kids. Okay, so Job would take care of the sacrifices for his family. And this was an upright man who obviously had been blessed. Now, in the patriarchal period, not having the written word from God, what they did have was oral tradition, some manuscripts that were written by Adam and others all the way down through Noah, who Noah brought through the flood and most likely had access to. And that's what Moses later got to write those first 11 chapters of Genesis. So there was some writing, but it was not coherent, was not put in one place, and not everybody had access to it. So what they did have, there was a wisdom philosophy, a wisdom teaching that was in many of the peoples post-flood. Many of the people groups had these written down, or at least they had teachers by oral tradition that would disseminate that information. And so Job lived by those wisdom teachings. He desired to know God. He sought God, and he didn't serve anybody else. Now, you remember, the world got pretty corrupt. And I wish I had time to fully develop this because it's really neat. The world had become very corrupt. Noah was the only one left righteous, so God just cleaned the slate. So we're going to start again. And so Noah came through the flood, had three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and they spread out and began to populate. Okay, when God took him through the flood, he gave him, for the second time, gave man the dominion mandate. Okay, he said, multiply, conquer the earth, take care of the critters, it's yours. Okay, he imparted some of his sovereignty to those men and women and gave them the opportunity to make their decisions and to live and take care of this earth. That was their responsibility. Okay, so the different people groups scattered out. There were some 70 on a list of different groups, and all the ones listed in Job, there's five or six or seven of them that are listed from Job and his friends and Elihu and others that were mentioned there. Those were all part of that list of 70, and so we know that in that, God's presence was still felt. And the three friends that come to Job and Elihu and others that surrounded and listened most likely were servers. They served God and not other gods, lower G. And so there still was an essence there. But there was no real written rule on practice. Okay, and we didn't have all that we know today about God. Excuse me. So we know Job was written sometime between the flood and Moses. And likely he was within a couple hundred years of Abraham, one way or the other, from all internal, from what we can see inside the book here. So let's carry on. Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also was among them. Now I want to stop right there and say Satan is not a good translation here. Actually, it's the adversary. The word used here in English Bibles typically is Satan, who we know the adversary and all the evil that's wrapped up against God is packaged in the term Satan. And actually, this early writing, it was not Satan that was spelled out, but the adversary or the, I can't think of the prosecutor. It was like a prosecuting attorney in a sense, that he was there to find your faults and accuse you before God. Okay, that was who this is talking about. So Satan also came among them. So there was a gathering. And the Lord said, Satan, from where did you come? And so Satan answered the Lord and said, from going to and fro on the earth and from walking back and forth on it. Then the Lord said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job? That there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, one who fears God and shuns evil. So Satan answered the Lord and said, "Does Job fear for nothing? Have you not made a hedge around him, around his household, and around all that he has on every side? You have blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But now," Satan saying to God, "stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will surely curse you to your face." And the Lord said to Satan, "Behold, all that he has is in your power. Only do not lay a hand on his person." So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. Okay, we have a heavenly council. It's a staff meeting. God calls the divines together. Okay, at that time, back in the creation, God made light at the very beginning. And with that light, we think, hypothesize, and this is a stretch because I'm not smart enough to know these things, but that the heavenlies were made at that time, that these angels were created. They were created by God as ministering spirits, and they were created at the same time he created light, or in that time period right there. So they were from early parts, but they didn't see God create the universe, okay? They just saw from that point forward. And really, they saw him create the earth and the man and all that's in it. But they were ministering spirits. They were not able to reproduce. They were not made in God's image, so they couldn't think like him. They didn't have God's power, although they did have quite a bit of power. But they were able to make their own choices. They could choose to rebel or to serve God. They were ministering spirits, and at this time, they were still mostly together with God, okay? So bear with me, if you will, as I go through this, because it's kind of tedious. But these sons of God are the angels, or the divines. They were created as ministering spirits, where man was created for God's fellowship. So there was a difference there. And the angels, in one sense, could be kind of envious because they could not experience what man did, and they couldn't be saved. They were not part of God's redemptive plan. So they could not experience some of the things that humans did. In Hebrews chapter 1, verses 13 and 14, let me see if I can find that quickly. I'd like to read that to you. I heard Chuck Swindoll preach on this once, and I still remember his inflection and everything. It was just so, he's such a powerful speaker. "But to which of these angels has God ever said, 'Sit at my right hand till I make your enemies your footstool'? Are they not all ministering spirits sent forth to minister for those who will inherit salvation?" So the angels, although they're in God's presence all the time, don't experience the same thing we do. And they don't have the same opportunity that we have. And they don't have access to salvation. Brad was preaching on 1 Peter. And in 1 Peter 1, verses 10 and 11, it says, of this salvation, the prophets have inquired and searched carefully, who prophesied of the grace that would come to you, searching what or what manner of time the Spirit of Christ who was in them was indicating when he testified beforehand the sufferings of Christ and the glories that would follow. To them it was revealed that, not to themselves, but to us, they were ministering the things which now have been reported to you through those who have preached the gospel to you by the Holy Spirit sent from heaven, things which angels desire to look into. So the angels, God, they're messengers from God. They do actions for God. There's an order in this structure where God is supreme, and the angels act only within the rules he allows them, okay? When he told Satan here that all things that Job has are in your power, but don't touch Job. Well, Satan didn't sneak around and touch Job. He knew better than that because he understood, I can't create anything. I can only mess with what God's already put out there. And if I make a mistake, I'm done. I'm toast. And so the adversary was just going to try this experiment, okay? It's almost like a scientific test. You put up a hypothesis, and then you go test it to see if it works. And Satan said, you know, if Job weren't so blessed, he wouldn't like you so much. If you took his stuff, he'll curse you to your face. So Job set the test up, and God said, okay, we'll see. And he said, you can have Job's stuff. So let's move on. Let me make sure I didn't miss something here. God takes Job's blessing in verses 13 and following. Now, I say that, God took it, not Satan. God doesn't just allow stuff. God actually is a controller of things. We know by the structure of heaven and all the hosts that God doesn't, he hasn't given any of his sovereignty to the angels to do things with. He said, okay, I'll have Job's stuff. You go get it, is the way I would read this, okay? Starting in verse 13, it says, now there was a day when his sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their house, in their oldest brother's house. And this is Job's sons and daughters. And a messenger came to Job and said, the oxen were plowing and the donkeys feeding beside them when the Sabians raided them and took them away. Indeed, they have killed the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you. While he was still speaking, that servant was still speaking, another also came and said, the fire of God fell from heaven and burned up in the sheep and the servants and consumed them, and I alone have escaped to tell you. And while that servant was still speaking, another also came and said, the Chaldeans formed three bands, raided the camels, took them away, yes, and killed the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you. While he was still speaking, another who came and said, your sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house, and suddenly a great wind came from across the wilderness and struck the four corners of the house, and it fell on the young people, and they're dead. And I alone escaped to tell you. Then Job arose. Now, first of all, in this first part here, it says that the fire from God came down, not the fire from Satan. Okay, so Satan was only using God's means, the tornado, the whirlwind, whatever, the fire from heaven belonged to God, but Satan did have control of it, or the adversary did. Then Job arose and tore his robe and shaved his head and fell on the ground and worshiped. Is that what we would, is that our response when something happens? You know, I find out that I've got some illness that I can't beat. Did I fall down and worship God for that? Unfortunately, I'm sorry. I didn't. It was not my nature, my character. It wasn't comfortable. But Job did. Job's heart was wholly God's, okay? And he said, naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return there. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Wow. Job had it right. He understood that all his stuff was really just God's stuff on loan, just like God's fire was on loan to Satan to use in his means. Okay, God is the creator. The heavenly bodies cannot create anything, and neither can we. So there's a big separation there. We need to get a hold of that truth. In all this, Job did not sin nor charge God with wrong. That is an incredible statement. And when God had said back at the very beginning of this, have you considered my servant Job? He's an upright and faithful man, sinless. That's God's summary of Job, not Job's of himself. It's interesting that when God took Job's stuff, that he worshiped God. He is the author of all things, and it was his right to give and take. Now, the second attack comes on Job. Let's read here in verse chapter 2. Again, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan came among them again to present himself before the Lord. So there's another staff meeting. And the Lord said, Satan, from where do you come? So Satan answered the Lord and said, from going to and fro throughout the earth, from walking back and forth on it. Then the Lord said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, and one who fears God and shuns evil, and still he holds fast to his integrity, although you incited him against me, or you incited me against him, I'm sorry, to destroy him without cause. Wow. God's holding the line here. He realizes Job has maintained the right perspective, even in light of the loss of all his goods. So Satan answered the Lord and said, skin for skin. Yes, all that a man has, he will give for his life. But stretch out your hand now and touch his bone and his flesh, and he'll curse you to your face. So Satan is now extending the hypothesis that, well, if man hurts bad enough, he's going to cave. Now, I think, let's take just a quick break here for a second and digress. Back during the pre-diluvian age, from Adam to the flood, man had become totally depraved. You think Satan wasn't involved in that? I think he was. And I think up to a third of the host, that we find out later, was involved with him, because they thought, you know, we can't have this salvation stuff. We can't get redeemed. We can't feel like they feel. We can't have children. We can't participate in life fully like these guys can. So why don't we destroy that experiment? God doesn't need their fellowship. He's got us. And let's bend this to our own devices. And so Satan and his folks were working with the older generation to warp their thinking. And in fact, it worked. And by the time Noah came along, God realized, hey, this is out of hand. And so he started over again. This time, Satan is trying again. He's starting. He wants to destroy Job, which would set off, a cascade, just like it happened before. If I can get Job under my fingernail, then we got the rest of these guys, because Job he's the most important man in the East, okay? And in those days, when they were living by the wisdom books, it was strictly if you're blessed, you're righteous. If you're being cursed, you're in sin. It was black and white. There was no in between, okay? So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and struck Job with painful boils from the soles of his foot to the crown of his head. And he took for himself a potsherd, which was to scrape himself, while he sat in the midst of the ashes. Then his wife said to him, do you still hold fast to your integrity? Curse God and die. Now there's a help meet that you all want, right? She lost her faith. She cursed God in her heart, and she told Job, do the same thing. This is over. There's something wrong with you, buddy, and God's not blessing you anymore, and I don't want any part of this. What did Job say to her? You speak as one of the foolish women speaks. Shall we indeed accept good from God, and shall we not accept adversity? In all this, Job did not sin with his lips. It's amazing that Job could do that. The car gets wrecked. It's no longer available to you, but you think, yeah, I can get another car. But let's say you have a health issue that you can't get rid of. That strikes a little closer to home. And Job was there now. He saw not only all of his things taken, his wife left him now. She has turned her back on him, and his health is no longer whole. He had a disease here. We're not sure what it was. There's some speculation, two or three things that might have been, leprosy being one of those. Regardless, he was a sick puppy, and he was sitting on an ash heap scraping his boils and sores, and he was literally rotting before their eyes. It was not a pretty sight, and yet he still did not curse God. He knew who he was, and I think this is really the whole point of this book of Job. It shows us the heavenly struggle. It shows us man's long war against God. It shows us a lot of things. We get some hints of how to respond by Job, how to respond to adversity. But really, looking deeper into this, what we need to see here is that Job knew God. Now, how many of you heard the phrase many evangelicals use? Your responsibility is to know God and to make him known. Okay, that sounds good. It's a good, pious thing to throw out there to your friends and neighbors. But what does it really mean to know God? Okay, you've heard me talk before about Micah 6:8. You know, what does God require of you? But to do justice and to love mercy and to walk humbly with your God. And there are other verses that I really love that go along with that. Walk with God. Know God. Experience his love. How do you do that? It's not as easy as just going to church on Sunday and you knew God for your hour for the week and that's it. No, this is who Job was. He had an innate understanding that God is God and he created me and he created all this. And I'm to serve him regardless. And I think that's where we need to get to. Now, we're not going to read the whole book, as I said. This next 40 chapters, I'm going to condense for you and summarize. And I would love for each of you to go home and read Job time or two just to get a handle on it, because it really is neat. There are three cycles of argumentation. He has three friends and some other guy, young, puffed up guy, Elihu, show up. And they get into a debate, and it starts out very humbly, and they're suggesting maybe, Job, isn't there something going on that you want to, fess up about? Because we know God's not blessing you now, so you got to be in sin, period. That's the only option. And it tumbles through second and into the third, which turns out to be just a big cuss fight. Job's yelling, and they're each yelling. It's hard to tell who's saying what because they're yelling at each other. And the bottom line was, Job said, no, I'm not in sin. My heart hasn't sinned either. You guys are wrong. And so Elihu, who I used to really like till I got to looking at this a lot, Elihu steps in he doesn't take their arguments because he sees that those arguments weren't convincing Job. And so let's go a step further. Maybe you're not in sin now. Maybe God is showing you something to change your direction so you won't sin in the future. And that sounds good, right? Well, the problem is that all this is solely based on man's thinking, not God's wisdom. And so God then intervenes. We get through the big cuss fight. Elihu says his piece. And it's interesting, as soon as he finishes, God says, enough's enough. Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, in chapter 38, who is this who darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Now, Elihu had just finished. And I was all thinking, Elihu's kind of got it right here. But God said, no, he doesn't. Who is this who darkens counsel by words without knowledge? And that could be stretched over all four of those guys, the friends, Elihu, and even Job, because Job was making his case, but Job was also a little bitter at God. God, you have not taken care of me like I thought you were going to. So now God continues, and I'm going to read part of 38, all of chapter 38, and then we'll break for a minute. Now prepare yourself like a man, he's talking to Job, God talking to Job. I will question you, and you shall answer me. Now Job had said in his argumentation, God, if you just would come down, if I could just get in your presence, and I ask you some questions, and you ask me some questions, we get this resolved. But that wasn't going to be, it wasn't possible. Job knew that he couldn't come before God because he was man, and God can't be in the same room with man without an intermediary. He needed a God-man, a mediator that was part God and part man that could stand between him and say, okay, God, this is what he's saying. What do you say back? And, you know, he could take care of that. And what do you think that is? Who do you think that is? It's Jesus, okay? Job saw the need for Jesus way back before there was ever any Bible, before there was ever any writing, before we all had the revelation that God gave through Abraham down through the prophets to Jesus. Job knew that. Job desired this mediator. And in chapter 9, verses 32 and 3, he says so much that, you know, I can't do this by myself. I wish I could, but I need a mediator. And then also at this time, Job and most of these men in the patriarchal era believed that there was no heaven as we understand it today. We've had more revelation. They thought you died, you went to the grave, you're in cold storage. But Job believed at some point there would be a redeemer who would bring us all back and we'll bodily see God in person, eye to eye. Okay, in verse 19, chapter 19, verse 25 through 27, let me read that real quick because it's really, I thought, this is Old Testament, right? This isn't even in the inspired line. This is in Job, which is some Gentile off in the east. And yet he has some knowledge of Jesus way back then, 25 here. For I know that my Redeemer lives, and he shall stand on at last on the earth, and after my skin is destroyed, meaning I've rotted in the ground, and I know that in my flesh I shall see God, whom I shall see for myself, and my eyes shall behold, and not another, how my heart yearns within me. Job realized that Jesus was coming. There was going to be a Redeemer. He was going to be a God-man, and he was going to stand in a gap and allow me to go into the presence of God. And Job said, just kill me now, put me in the ground, put me in cold storage. I want to wait till then, because when I get there, I know I'll be vindicated. That was his thinking, I believe. Now, God picks up in 38, after he chastens Elihu, but I think it stretches to all of them. I'm going to question you, and you shall answer me. Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. Who determined its measurements? Surely you know. Or who watched the line upon it? To what were its foundations fastened? Or who laid its cornerstone? When the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy. So these ministering spirits, the angels, were available when God was building the earth, and they were rejoicing because they were seeing something new unfold. They didn't understand totally at that time what it meant to them, but they saw this creative genius at work, and they were ecstatic, okay? Or who shut in the sea with doors when it burst forth and issued from the womb and made clouds his garment and the thick darkness his swaddling band, when I fixed my limit for it and set bars and doors, when I said, this far you may come, but no further, and here your proud ways must stop. This is talking about the flood, okay? The earth opened up, flood, the blanket of rain around it came down, flooded the earth, destroyed what man knew of the earth, and when the water receded, it was not the same earth that it was before the flood. And so that's what God's talking about here. And Job knew that. It was only a couple of 300 years before he lived. It would be like the founding of our country. We weren't there, but we do know from historians and pictures and everything else, we know pretty much what it looked like back then. Well, Job was the same way. He probably was only a couple of generations away from the flood. And so this was fresh to him. He knew what God was talking about, but he didn't know the answers to God's questions. Have you commanded the morning since your days began and caused the dawn to know its place, that it might take hold of the ends of the earth and the wicked be shaken out of it. It takes on form like clay under a seat, or under a seal, and stands out like a garment. From the wicked, their light is withheld, and the upraised arm is broken. Have you entered the springs of the sea? Now, that interesting thought there, the springs of the sea. Most people thought, Bible being unscientific, this was crazy. What's he talking about here? It turns out about 60 years, more than that now, 80 years ago, they found rivers of water in the bottom of the ocean that were the springs of the sea that were an incredible force, okay? So Job knew about it, or God told Job, hey, I got springs down there under that water, and you'll find them someday. Don't worry about it. So man didn't know, and God is revealing himself to Job here. Or have you walked in search of the depths? Have the gates of death been revealed to you? Or have you seen the door of the shadow of death? Have you comprehended the breadth of the earth? And tell me if you know all this. Where is the way to the dwelling of light and darkness? Where is its place? That you may take it to its territory, that you may know the paths to its home. Do you know it? Because you were born then, or because the number of your days is great? In other words, here's your life, you know, here's my time span. You know, how much have you gathered experientially in that little bit of time? Not much. Have you entered the treasury of snow? And this is probably talking about the ice age, the northern polar caps and southern, where the snow is built and the ice is built up, and it's not many from the Middle East at that time had been up there, but they knew it existed. Or have you seen the treasury of hail, which I reserve for the time of trouble, for the day of battle and war? By what way is light diffused, or the east wind scattered over the earth? Who has divided a channel for the overflowing water, or a path for the thunderbolt, to cause it to rain on a land where there is no one, a wilderness to which there is no man, to satisfy the desolate waste and cause to spring forth the growth of tender grass? Has the rain a father? Or who has begotten the drops of dew? From whose womb comes the ice and the frost of heaven? Who gives it birth? The waters harden like stone, and the surface of the deep is frozen. And it's talking about those big ice caps that are out there. Can you bind the cluster of the Pleiades? Now he's talking about stars. Can you gather those in your hand and wad up the Pleiades, which are, as we now know, separated by many light years apart? It would be a phenomenal task. And yet Jesus, in fact, flung them out. He created that. Or loose the belt of Orion. Can you bring out the Maseroth in its season? Or can you guide the Great Bear with his cubs? Do you know the ordinances of the heavens? Can you set their dominion over the earth? I'm going to quit there. This is beautiful, and I guess as homework, I'd ask for you to go ahead and read the remainder of 38. I'd just start over and read 38 through about 41 just to get a grip on how great God is and how powerful he is and how much he knows, okay? Also, if you don't have time to do all that, just read Psalm 19. Mm-hmm. Psalm 19 is just short, 25 verses, and it condenses all this into the essence. But it's interesting to see that God, when God is confronted with the question, why did you take my stuff? Why did you make me sick? He could have answered in one line if he wanted to, but he didn't. What did he do? He had four chapters of Job talking about the creation. Now, that's odd. How could that possibly be the answer to Job's question of why did you take my stuff? Well, it's interesting. Let me digress for just a minute. I got a personal thing here that I wanted to share with you. Dr. E.E. Conkey, He's a nuclear physicist. He was one of my profs in college 100 years ago. And he was a brilliant man. He was actually playing handball under the court where they had the first critical reactor take place there in Manhattan. Really interesting guy. Had lots and lots. It's kind of like Joe here. He knew. He was at the beginning of my profession, and he saw it all unfold, okay? And I'm in a nuclear physics class, graduate level class, and we're talking about stuff that nobody knows anything about. And we got into electromagnetic radiation. He was talking about some interactions and all. He was giving me the facts, and here's how it interacts. And after class, I thought, you know, this is stump the dummy time. You know, I've always wondered this, and here's a guy that probably knows, so I'm just going to ask him. So I boldly go up to the front after the class and get his attention, and he said, what do you need? And I said, you know, I've just been noodling with this for some time. You're talking electromagnetic radiation. That's what light is, okay? There's a whole spectrum of it, from light to hard gamma rays, which penetrate deep and cause damage in your body. And so we're looking at the interaction of gammas and how do they fly over time and how do they impart energy to other bodies. And I said, Dr. Conkey, can you explain to me the mechanism by which a massless, chargeless entity like a waveform, electromagnetic radiation, passing through a cloud of electrons, which are they have mass and they have charge. How do they interact? I mean, you can understand if you take a billiard ball and you roll it across the table and it hits ball and you see them scatter. You see that ball interact with others, okay? Mass interacting with other mass. If you take an electrical component, sometimes you'll see magnetic fields repel each other. And a positive charge and another positive charge are not, they respond to each other. But when you've got nothing and a solid body with a negative charge, how does that actually interact and impart energy? And so I braced, and he said, young man, if you could answer that, you'll win the Nobel Prize. I thought, oh, so you don't know. And that was exactly the answer. He didn't. There are things that we don't know. Brilliant people can't get their arms around some things that are real, tangible, okay? And that was one example. I've got some others. But I started losing faith in the science, which is not necessarily right either, but these guys were trying to tell me that they had a handle on this, and really all they said was, well, we've seen some stuff happen, and here's what we saw. Job is confronted by God in the same way with some tough questions. You know, did you see the foundations of the earth laid? Who did it? How big are they? You know, where was this rock hung out here in the universe? How does it stay here? There are things that have never been answered and won't until we all go home, and Job had to sit back and realize, I got what I prayed for. I got my confrontation with God, and woof, you know. That's why all those who have seen God in Scripture and recorded it, their immediate response was to fall flat on their face. It's like, I can't deal with this. There's too much holiness here. There's too much power here. We can't fathom who God really is. We can be pompous and think we know, and we can talk like we've got this great relationship with God. We know him well, and yet we can't even understand how he made us, okay? If I have something happen to me and I'm upset with God about it or upset with somebody else about it, how can the clay tell the potter what you need to be doing to make me right? You know, we can't challenge God in that area. So we just have to know that if he could do all these things, if he knew how the gamma passing by an electron cloud would impart energy, then I ought to just sit back, take my ease, and realize God's got this. Okay? I need to trust him. When Job was faced with God's creative genius, when he was confronted by it, he realized, I stepped in deep water, and I don't have a life raft. And so what did Job do? In chapter 42, I'll just read a couple of verses here. Then Job answered the Lord, and after a lot of this, same kind of talk, I know that you can do everything, and that no purpose of yours can be withheld from you. You ask, who is this who hides counsel without knowledge? Therefore I have uttered what I did not understand, things too wonderful for me, which I did not know. Listen, please, and let me speak. You said, I will question you, and you shall answer me. I have heard of you by the hearing of the ear. Okay, he had heard by the hearing of the ear, the oral traditions, and even the written stuff that he was able to get his arms around. He had seen and heard of God. But now my eyes have seen you. Therefore I abhor myself and I repent in dust and ashes. Job, at this point, realized, I'm speaking out of turn. I don't have the big picture. And if you really are that great, why should I even challenge you on this? You did this for a reason that I can't know and understand. And so it's not my job to sort that out. I am to live in the fear of you. I am to walk with a witness to other people that I know you and that I trust you, even though, you know, the people around me say, curse God and die. My responsibility is to walk uprightly, to walk with you, and to represent you well. I need to know you first, and I really want to. And I think in Job's case, when confronted with the creation story, he saw God for the first time. And I think that's still true today. The book of John, which was written kind of as an evangelical tool, how does it begin? In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was God, and the Word was with God, and through him all things that were made. Okay, it's the creation story. He's starting out by telling us that, look, if you just could get a grip on who made you and understand, or not even understand, but just realize how that powerful that is, it should affect you to the core of your life. And that's why I think a number of times Paul and others have written that there's enough out here in nature for someone with no Bible and no knowledge and no preacher to look at. If he just stops and thinks and looks around him and says, how'd that gamma knock that electron out of the cloud? It's enough to know that there is a God. And I think we need to get a grasp of that. So as homework, I've mentioned a time or two already, as homework, I'd like to leave you with this. Read Psalm 19 and or the last four chapters or so of Job, and just spend some time meditating on who God is and how you, what your role is in relation to all that. Let's pray. Father, I thank you for your word. We are so fortunate. Job did not have what we have. You've continued to progress the revelation of yourself into what we now know as the Bible. We have access to knowledge of you. We can see things that Job could only dream about or hope for. Our understanding of you has expanded. Our knowledge of how you work and act and react is expanded, and so we are without excuse. I just pray, Lord, that you would have mercy on me and all those within the hearing of my voice, that everyone who loves you would get a grip on the reality of your power and your glory and your majesty, that we would not question you about things that have no real eternal value, but that we would rather, as Job said, blessed is the Lord. You give, you take away, it's your right. And who are we to question that? Lord, I pray for understanding, that you just lift the scales from each of our eyes and help us to see you from a new perspective. And most of all, I guess, like to see action. I just want to, in my own life and those around me, just to see that work outwardly so that it affects who we are and that we continue to carry the banner for you in this lost and dying world. As we face persecution is coming, I just ask that you give us this understanding, this love of you that would transcend all the pain, the agony, the failures, et cetera, that we're to encounter. And Lord, help us to come through that with flying colors, not to boast about, but rather to represent you well so that we do our job in your plan of redemption. We want fellowship with you, just like you created us for. And Lord, I pray that you would reveal to each of your servants here today exactly how that would play out in their lives. We thank you and praise you in Jesus' precious name. Amen. Does anybody have any announcements that we need to share? Yes, Kathy. Okay. Sounds good. Next Sunday. So if you haven't talked to Kathy already, look at the list and sign up. What else? Anybody else? I don't know.